When the Zapatistas of Chiapas, Mexico, launched a rebellion on New Year's Day 1994, they took much of the world by surprise, garnering international attention and pioneering a military strategy based more on words than weapons, which the RAND Corporation calls, quote, net war. On July 2nd, 2 weeks into a red alert, with progressives around the world scanning the internet with anticipation, the Zapatistas announced a broad new political initiative to break out of the stalemate with government occupation forces. To discuss the recent developments, we're joined by phone with Bill Weinberg, author of Homage to Chiapas and numerous articles on the rebellion.
Hi, good to be here.
The latest reorientation of the movement was outlined by Subcomandante Marcos on a long communique from July 2nd. So can you talk a little bit about what was said in that communique and what new initiatives the Zapatistas are planning?
Well, if you're talking about the so-called sixth declaration of the Lacandon Selva, you'll note that it was not signed by Marcos. It was signed by the indigenous clandestine committee, which is the general command of the Zapatistas, the Indigenous Revolutionary Clandestine Committee, which is the indigenous command of the general command of the Zapatistas, and is an all indigenous body. So this was not one of the more personalistic communiques from Subcommander Marcos, who is sort of public voice of the Zapatistas and who is not an Indian. This seems to have been written by committee, I would imagine. And it was serialized in the Mexican newspapers in three parts. The first was entitled Who We Are, and outlined the history of the Zapatista struggle and how they've arrived at the current stalemate, basically through the government's intransigence in refusing to abide by the one condition which was worked out in rather fitful peace negotiations over the years for the Zapatistas to convert themselves into some kind of a political entity as opposed to a clandestine military entity, which was for the government to change the constitution to recognize the rights for indigenous people. We can talk more about that later. The second part was called How We See the World, and was sort of an exegesis on the contemporary globalized capitalist system, and particularly the role of Mexico within it. And the third, which just came out on the 2nd, as you say, when it was finally completed, was entitled What We Want to Do. That talks a bit about what their new strategy is.
Can you talk a little bit about what that strategy entails?
Yeah, well, I can just talk about what was in the communique. We'll see what the strategy actually entails. I mean, it begins by declaring solidarity with indigenous and popular struggles throughout Latin America, singling out Bolivia and Ecuador, as well as with Venezuela and Cuba in their path of resistance, quote-unquote. And it even offers to send a bus loaded with indigenous mayas from Chiapas to the Cuban embassy in Mexico City as a symbolic donation to ride out the embargo. And it also, more significantly, announces the Zapatistas' new plan to send a delegation to travel throughout Mexico, building alliances with other popular organizations in a bid to unite the left and indigenous movements with the ultimate aim of a new constitution in Mexico that, quote, defends the weak against the powerful, end quote. And the statement says the delegation will only work with non-electoral movements and those which embrace principles of popular democracy, or what we might call, grassroots democracy, rather than seeking to impose upon those on those below, as the communique put it. They're sort of seeking people who share their vision, and there seems to be something of a distancing from the traditional electoral left in Mexico, the Party of the Democratic Revolution, or the PRD.
Yeah, I found that definitely interesting. And what Reuters and Associated Press are saying is that this announcement is timed to coincide with the elections that are going to be happening in 2006, where Obrador from the Left OD is a front runner in the polls. So do you think the timing of this has anything to do with the election, or do you think that they're working on their own schedule?
That's an interesting question, and I don't want to speculate. I will say that, there's been this whole controversy with Andre Manuel López Obrador, who is now the mayor of Mexico City and was formerly a leader of indigenous struggles in Tabasco, which is a state bordering Chiapas down in southern Mexico, back in the mid-1990s when the Zapatistas were leading their struggle in Mexico, Lopez Obrador, just immediately, one state to the north in Tabasco, was also leading an indigenous struggle against Pemex, the state oil company, which had been polluting the lands of the Indians, you know, for their farming lands and their fishing lands for a long time with impunity. So he was actually leading, you know, occupations of the oil fields and so on by Indians to demand that Pemex clean up its act and indemnify the Indians for their destroyed land. And this was sort of how he built his political base. And then after being, you know, sort of the PRD's political boss in Tabasco, he moved on to become the mayor of Mexico City and a very popular figure in Mexico. And now there's all of this fear, I believe, not only amongst amongst the administration of President Vicente Fox, but also among the administration of George Bush. I think we can state that without too much speculation, that he will, in fact, be Mexico's next president. And that we could have, you know, a situation as with Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, only right next door in Mexico, which is something which I can assure you the prospect they're not very happy about in Washington. So there was this whole affair, which we saw earlier this year, where the federal government was trying to bar his candidacy through legalistic means. They found some very, very petty corruption, especially by Mexican standards, which had to do with paving a road to a hospital in the federal district without having gone through the official channels. And they tried to – they actually launched a case against him on the basis of this, which would take away his ability to run for president. So this was seen overtly as a politically motivated case, and there was, you know, a widespread movement amongst the entire Mexican you know, left to fight it, and including, you know, the Zapatistas. I believe Marcos himself actually issued a statement saying that this was politically motivated and it should be opposed. And finally, the government capitulated to the pressure and dropped the case. So now Manuel Lopez Obrador is free to run. And just as this happened, Marcos issued a new communique essentially accusing him of being a strong man, of being a caudillo, and being too politically ambitious. And that he is and saying that the PRD is beginning to mirror the PRI, which is the Institutional Revolutionary Party, which had been the one party, you know, the only party in Mexico throughout the years of the one party state, which was from 1929 to the year 2000 when Fox was elected. So that's very interesting. So we don't quite know, you know, what the position of the Zapatistas is going to be if, in fact, Manuel Lopez Obrador you know, is elected or gets anywhere near the Mexican White House. It's called the White House in Mexico, too. But it always, you know, the Zapatistas have emphasized, even at times when they've been in something of an alliance with the PRD in Chiapas, in terms of PRD-run municipalities in Chiapas have supported the Zapatistas' parallel government. They've also always been rather critical of the PRD and critical of electoral politics generally. I think this could be seen as wanting to empower grassroots non-electoral movements, if only to serve as a check on power, no matter who's in power, whichever one of the three parties in Mexico comes out on top. It will be very interesting to watch next year.
I want to step back a little bit. Can you just briefly run through some of the main events that have happened with around the Zapatista situation since the big news in 94 to inform us as to how we got to this point, how we got to the red alert, and then this new political initiative?
Well, sure. I can try to sum up 11 years of history in a little Reader's Digest version. The Zapatistas launched their revolt on January 1st, 1994, which was quite significantly the very moment that NAFTA took effect. And they issued a statement saying that NAFTA was going to be a death sentence for the indigenous peoples of Mexico. And they marched out of the jungle in Chiapas, where they had been preparing for many years. and they took over four towns in the highlands of Chiapas, and they this precipitated 12 days of war when the Mexican government counterattacked, and there was really pretty horrific bloodshed, and Indian villages were subject to aerial bombardment and so on. And almost immediately, if I recall correctly, on January 12th of 1994, there was a huge rally in Mexico City calling for a halt to the repression, probably the biggest rally that Mexico had seen since the 1960s, calling on both sides to negotiate. And this is what the Zapatistas did. So technically, they were only at war in 1994. And since then, they have been seeking a negotiated solution. And I arrived in Chiapas when the very first round of negotiations were beginning in February of 1994 in the cathedral at San Cristobal de las Casas. And they had a whole list of demands which they wanted action on, basically calling for counter reforms to the Mexican Constitution, we might say, because the Mexican Constitution itself had been changed in preparation for NAFTA. And this was one of the most critical things which brought about the Zapatista movement, is that the communal lands, which they called ejidos, of the peasant communities in Mexico, which were guaranteed in perpetuity to these communities under the Mexican Constitution as a gain of the original Mexican Revolution of 1910 to 1919, and as a fruit of the insurgency of Emiliano Zapata. I remember the Marlon Brando movie and all that. Called for that. This was guaranteed. These lands would belong to the peasants in perpetuity. Well, in 1993, in the immediate prelude of NAFTA and in preparation for NAFTA, changes to the Constitution were pushed through saying that these ejidos, these communal lands, could be privatized. They could be sold off to the highest bidder. They could be used as collateral for loans and so on. And this is one of the things which they wanted changed, because they just saw this as a recipe for the Indians being expropriated of their lands, because all of this cheap corn, the agribusiness corn from the United States, genetically engineered, heavily subsidized, ultra-cheap corn was going to flood into Mexico as the trade barriers went down under NAFTA, and the indigenous producers were going to be priced off the market. And by and large, that is, in fact, what has happened in the intervening 10 years. So they essentially were calling for a whole measure of counter-reforms to the Constitution, and their very first demand was for autonomy for indigenous peoples. And what's happened since then, there's been this cycle, and I think that we're still in this cycle today, as a matter of fact, where there have been hardliners within the government and the more moderates who really do want some kind of negotiated solution, even if they don't want to negotiate in good faith, even if they just want to sort of buy the Zapatistas off. They at least want to pursue a negotiated solution, as opposed to the hardliners who would just like to crush them. And at various periods, one faction has had the upper hand, and at various periods, the other has had the upper hand. And the first time that, finish up what happened in 1994, the first time the cycle really began is that after that first round of negotiations, the government gave the Zapatistas some proposals. And they went back to their communities to talk them over with their own people, which is how they do everything. They have what's called consultas, which are like consultations where everybody in the community, in the communities which the sort of base support communities of the Zapatistas, everybody is talks it over, and they sort of arrive at a decision through consensus. And we've just seen that process happen again. So, but what happened back then, and this would have been probably April or May of 1994, they decided that they rejected the government's proposals. That was the first stalemate. And shortly after that, the government announced that they had issued arrest warrants for the Zapatista leadership, and they invaded their stronghold. And that was when the Zapatistas for the first time declared a red alert, as they just did around 10 days ago now. And then there was, a period when they were fleeing into the jungle, And the government was arming paramilitary groups to try to, you know, terrorize the communities which supported them back into submission and so on. And there was the terrible massacre. This ultimately culminated in the terrible massacre in 1997 at Akdiyal, where 45 unarmed Indians were killed in the middle of a prayer meeting, actually. They were part of a group called Las Abejas, or the Bees, which was actually not a part of the Zapatista movement, but sympathetic to the Zapatistas, but also was explicitly a pacifist group, sort of like an indigenous Catholic pacifist group, but supportive of the Zapatistas' parallel government in Chiapas. 45 of them were killed while praying, literally, in a hamlet up in the Chiapas Highlands called Akdiyal. But ultimately, I think that the government realized, well, throughout all of this period, the Institutional Revolutionary Party remained in power, and I think that the government realized that they were going to have to allow for free elections if there wasn't actually going to be some kind of social explosion in Mexico. And they did, and Vicente Fox came to power in the year 2000. Ironically, from the not from the left opposition party, the PRD, the Party of the Democratic Revolution, but from the right opposition party, the National Action Party, the PAN. And he played his cards very, very well. And one of the things which he did is that he promised that he would end the he would bring about a negotiated settlement in Chiapas in 15 minutes if he took power. And the reason that the way that he would do this is that he would sign the San Andres Accords. The San Andres Accords were the peace accords which had finally been worked out when the Zapatistas were brought back to the negotiating table this would have been also in 1997, the same year as the Akdiyal massacre. They went back to the negotiating table and they sat down with representatives from the Mexican Congress and they worked out an accord for the first minimum demand for peace, which again were changes to the Mexican Constitution calling for indigenous communities to have their own self-governing autonomy within Mexico. And then there was supposed to be, after that was approved by Congress and signed by the president, and the constitutional changes were made, then they were supposed to go back to the dialogue table and continue to move on to other issues and their other demands concerning agrarian reform and just general democratic rights in Mexico and other issues. So, but it never got to that point because the president of Mexico at the time was Ernesto Zedillo, the last president from the Institutional Revolutionary Party, or the PRI, refused to sign them. He said this is a dangerous call for the balkanization of Mexico, and he refused to sign it. So this left Vicente Fox with a very facile strategy. He said that he would immediately sign the San Andres Accords and bring peace to Chiapas in 15 minutes if he was elected. And he did that. He did actually sign the San Andres Accords. But then it had to be ratified by Congress. And I think this was a very cynical strategy on Fox's part because he knew that his party, the National Action Party, had enough seats in Congress to block the reform, to block the San Andres Accords, even though he signed it. So he, you know, came out smelling like a rose, but his own allies in Congress essentially gutted the accord, not only from the PAN, but also some of the conservatives from the PRI, because Congress was pretty much divided equally three ways at this point, still is, between the PRI, the PAN, and the PRD. So the accords were rewritten, and essentially, as they currently stand, they allow for a certain degree of cultural autonomy for giving indigenous municipalities the right to govern themselves in their own indigenous languages and so on, but not what we could call actual territorial autonomy, meaning no actual control of natural resources on the land, which is the critical thing for the Zapatistas. So the Zapatistas say no. These are not the accords which we signed, and we're not going along with this. And once again, they broke off dialogue with the government. This was after they had an historic rally. I believe it was in March of 2001. They actually held a rally in Mexico City. So this is not the first time, in fact, that Zapatistas have traveled outside of Chiapas. as they're now proposing. They did this in 2001 as well, when they actually held a rally with their ski masks on, but without their guns, in Mexico City, calling for the San Andreas Accords to be ratified by Congress. And they were very optimistic at that point, and in fact, they actually addressed Congress. Some of the Zapatista leaders, not Marcos, but some of the indigenous leaders, the members of the Indigenous Revolutionary Clandestine Committee, actually addressed the Mexican Congress. And they were very optimistic at this point, but what happened is that, as I say, the accords were gutted, and since then, it's been a stalemate. And since then, the Zapatistas have sort of been wondering what to do next. And one of the things which they've done is that the government has not actually, you know, used any military action against them. They've groomed these paramilitary groups, such as that which carried out the massacre at Acteal, to use against them. It's been fairly bloody, but the government actually hasn't launched, like, an official army offensive against them. So they still control a lot of territory in Chiapas. And in this territory which they control, they've been going ahead and putting their parallel government into place, which they see as a model for what their constitutional changes call for all of Mexico. And this is what they've essentially been doing ever since the San Andreas Accords were rejected in 2001. I think what we've just witnessed is that they've, there are still elements within the movement which have been saying, well, you know, this is all very, very fine. We've sort of become a model for our vision of Mexico. But, you know, really, we, from the beginning, from 1994, we've had national ambitions. We consider ourselves the Zapatista National Liberation Army. We're not just about Chiapas. And we need to do something to reassert our presence on the national stage. And that's why they've taken this most recent move.
And on the internet at www.ckdu.ca. I'm Chris Arsenault, and I'm speaking today with Bill Weinberg, author of Homage to Chiapas, and we're talking about the recent situation there. You've talked about the need for a national presence from on behalf of the Zapatistas, and I'm wondering, I was speaking with Luis Alvarez about a year ago, who is Vincent A. Fox's PAN's chief negotiator for Chiapas. He was actually recently expelled from Guadalupe Tepeyac. And his line, I think, echoes that of the current Fox administration, and that's that, you know, that the Zapatistas or the poor Indians in Mexico had a good reason to rebel. They were very marginalized. But the Zapatistas couldn't carry through on their political gains. Nothing's actually changed on the ground. And they've lost their support bases. And that's kind of, what I'd say is the party line. So I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about what's actually happening on the land that the Zapatistas control now, the areas that they've established under their own governance. What sort of things are they doing? And how does that reality on the ground of the things they're creating play into this idea of their continued national ambitions?
Well, as I say, they're trying to implement their own program for local autonomous self-government for indigenous peoples. And they've got a whole series in Chiapas of what they call autonomous municipalities, which are run by committees, by indigenous councils, and support the Zapatistas. They've got a civilian wing, which are these indigenous councils, and then they also have, very often with the personnel overlapping, I would imagine, representatives to the Zapatista General Command, the Indigenous Revolutionary Clandestine Committee.
I'm wondering if you can, about the current, the Red Alert the Zapatistas declared, that came on the heels of what people in the government were saying was marijuana that the people in the Mexican government said was being grown on lands that were under Zapatista influence. And the Zapatistas have been very adamant from day one that they had nothing to do with the narcotraficantes. So you've written a little bit about drugs and power in Latin America, and I'm wondering what your take on the whole situation with the alleged marijuana was and how that plays out in the broader context.
Well, the Zapatistas are very puritanical. Both alcohol and marijuana are banned entirely from their strongholds. Alcohol in particular has been very, very instrumental in keeping the Indians in Chiapas down for centuries. You know, this whole sort of culture of ritual drunkenness, which, you know, plays right in with the rule of the corrupt political bosses who often are the ones who sell the hooch cane liquor that they keep the populace soused on, and plays in with abuse of women and so on. So this whole experience of this history has actually made the Zapatistas very puritanical. They are certainly not growing any marijuana on their lands. And in fact, the irony is that the people who are growing marijuana in Chiapas, and very often, because I mean, what the situation now in Chiapas sort of is a patchwork of villages which are controlled by the Zapatistas, and those which are controlled by the traditional political bosses in Chiapas, who they call the caciques. And you know, very often these villages will just be, you know, right next to each other, right down the road from each other. So and largely the ones who are growing the marijuana are the caciques, the traditional political bosses. I mean, and it's very obvious they're the ones who are driving around in you know, shiny new four-wheel drive pickups, and they're the ones who are tight with the authorities, so they get thrown a wink by the state police and by the army, so that they can grow the marijuana and, you know, and can harvest it and get it to market and so on. You know, it's all mixed up. The drug trade always has been all mixed up with the, you know, the ruling political machine in Mexico, which the Zapatistas are completely estranged from, needless to say. More than once in the past, this has served as an expedient for, you know, the presence of marijuana adjacent to the Zapatista lands in Chiapas has served as an expedient when the government has wanted to send in troops and goad the Zapatistas into war, or just usurp them from their lands, you know, just terrify them away. And that's happened more than once, in fact, particularly the village of Oventique, which is a Zapatista autonomous municipality just outside of San Cristobal de las Casas. The army has gone up there on supposed anti-marijuana maneuvers and, you know, set up encampments right outside the village. And the population, particularly, you know, in the period when things were very, very tense in the late 1990s, you know, the population fled, you know, for fear of their lives. Because you know, the army had set up an encampment right outside their borders. So, you know, it's interesting. Just before the Zapatistas declared this red alert, the army had been doing the same thing. It had been on so-called anti-marijuana maneuvers in Chiapas. There was some speculation that this might have influenced the Zapatista red alert. In retrospect, I'm not so sure that that's the case, actually. I think that they just had this red alert because they were going to hold this consulta in which they decided to take this new political direction, which is outlined in the Sixth Declaration of the Lacandon Selva. And they put their leadership in hiding and so on merely so that this consulta could be held. And cynically, one might say, as a sort of an attention-grabbing move so that there, you know, there would be a lot of media play when, in fact, they issued the new declaration. I'm not so sure that the marijuana maneuvers, the anti-marijuana maneuvers, had that much to do with it. And a recent statement, actually, by the Fray Bartolomé de las Casas Human Rights Center in Chiapas, which has monitored the whole conflict very, very closely from the very beginning, actually said that most of the communities where the government had been on these maneuvers, uprooting fields of marijuana, were not actually communities which were controlled by the Zapatistas. So once again, it's not the Zapatistas who are growing this stuff. I mean, one can have certain criticisms of the Zapatista movement, but the notion that they're growing drugs is simply a lie. And in fact, it's not even a lie which officially the Mexican government holds to. I mean, certain elements in the hardline elements in Mexican politics who accuse the Zapatistas of being delinquent have made these kind of accusations, but there isn't even enough water in them for the government to hold to them. And in fact, even when they've gone on these anti-marijuana maneuvers in Chiapas, very, very close to Zapatista-held territory, they've never actually made the charge that the Zapatistas are the ones growing the stuff.